This is the San Joaquin Sound Podcast. I'm your host, AJ Rodriguez. I'm here with Mark De Leon, who was a promoter in Bakersfield all throughout the 80s. He was also a part of the Gilman Street scene. He has owned a tattoo shop here in town for over 30 years, and he has the coolest Kiss-themed van in the world.
Thank you.
So let's go back to the start. What was growing up in Bakersfield like for you?
It was pretty hard. I lived in a neighborhood called the MoMA, and me and my brother were into rock and roll, and we're Hispanic, or Mexican, however you want to say it. We got called a coconut, got chased down, got in fights over just us liking Kiss and music like that, Van Halen and stuff. It was pretty challenging, I could say. Like I said, we were called coconuts, brown on the out and white on the in, you know?
Yeah.
So it was rough, but my older brother, who just passed away a few weeks ago, he played guitar. He started at the age of 13, and there's a five-year gap between us, which really got me into playing guitar and bass and whatever I did, because I've kind of been a jack-of-all-trades, master of none, you know?
And sometimes many is better than one.
Yeah, because sometimes you just got to have a bass player, and okay, I'll put down the guitar and play bass, you know?
Yeah. So growing up, what type of music did your parents listen to?
You know what? My mom listened to traditional Mexican music and oldies and a little bit of disco. And my dad, he liked Led Zeppelin and stuff, but he also liked Freddie Fender and Cornelio Reyna and Vicente Fernandez and Antonio Aguilar, you know. So it was pretty diverse, you know. And then, you know, one of my uncles is a pretty famous Latin jazz player. So we always had the music, plus, you know, there was other guitar players in our family and stuff.
That's cool. So do you remember the first concert you attended when you were a kid?
Yeah. You know, at the fair, I'd see all kinds of bands come through. Grand Funk Railroad. Man, anybody that was popular.
This is when they were playing Sam Good, or when it was during the fair times?
During the fair time. Because at a really early age, that's when I could see, like, rock bands. I've been to concerts, but they were more ranchera concerts. Like, you would go to the fairgrounds and at where they do the rodeos and stuff.
Yeah.
There would be, like, Antonio Aguilar would be in town, and they would do mariachis and music out there while riding horses and stuff. So that was my first kind of culture thing with that. And then the fair, we'd go to the fair every year, and I would see, you know, whoever was playing at the auditorium out there, you know, the Budweiser Pavilion as they know it now. I don't know what it was called back then, but I got to see a lot of stuff. And then even at an early age, I think I was maybe 10 years old, I stumbled in on a sound check. The Bakersfield Inn had a Chinese restaurant in it, and my dad was a big part of the American Legion, and they were having some kind of Legionnaires dinner there. And the other part of where the dinner was in the other banquet room was Quiet Riot doing a sound check before they were famous. And I went in there as a little kid, and I was like, man, you guys got Marshalls and Ampeg, SVTs, and Tom, you know. I was, like, naming off the drum sets and, like, oh, you got 26-inch bass drums. And they were like, well, how's this kid know all this stuff? So they let me hang out and watch it. And that kind of worked for me for a lot of, I mean, I got to do that with Night Ranger. And a lot of bands would say, hey, kid, you know a lot. You want to watch a sound check and stuff? And this was, like, at the Civic and stuff.
So that's cool.
I got to see a lot of cool things just by, I was the kid that had the balls to get in there and do what I had to do to go check out the band. And I wanted to go see, you know, I didn't get to see Quiet Riot play at the Bakersfield, but I got to see him play for soundcheck, you know?
Yeah.
It was cool.
For front row seat then.
Yeah, by myself, you know?
Yeah. So were you already playing guitar by this time? Because, like you said, and
no.
My condolences about your older brother, but was he your guitar teacher?
No, he didn't want me to play guitar at all.
Oh.
My brother was a little difficult. He hated me wanting to play guitar or anything. I was working in the CETA program working at BC in my freshman year, which you're not supposed to. You're only supposed to get into that your senior year. But no internet. They didn't check my age. So I'm a custodian all summer long at BC, and I made enough to buy a Charvel guitar. And
nice.
And, you know, about 1984. And I took it home. My brother was so jealous, he hit me with the guitar, which broke my arm, and then he smashed it on the porch, you know?
Oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, it was one of those kind of brother things, you know, that just kind of, you
some
know, it
real
was hard.
Sibling rivalry.
Yeah, but we loved each other, but I don't know, man. I don't know why he had such a problem with it, but I did it anyway, and I, you know, I've been around the world playing music, and, you know, I don't know if that bugged him, you know, but, you know, I did a lot with it.
What was your first band?
My first band was with Todd Thompson, who was later known as Big Jed, or Rory Todd Thompson, and it was called SMD, and it was a thrash metal band without knowing that what thrash metal was, or thrash hardcore punk, or whatever, and it was lightning super fast. I was 11 years old, 12 years old, and when people look at, like, I have video of it, and they look at the date on the video, and they hear the band, like, Ron from the record store is like, what made you play like that, you know? And I was like, I don't know. We just did. And it was with him and a guy named Greg, who's a pro skateboarder, and we just played where we could and got to, you know, give out tapes to people. Hey, this is our band. Let us play. And it would be some random stuff, and they let us play, and they'd hate us, and you know, at these regular rock gigs, and that was SMD was short-lived. It lasted a few years, but it was pretty short-lived, and we had about 300 meanings for it. The main meaning was pretty crude, you know, suck my blah, and then, like, as the time went on, it was Sean and Madonna's divorce, spaghetti and meatball dinners, shitty messy diapers, you know, and we had...
You could just say whatever
for
a joke,
whatever.
You know, you could
fit
whatever you want.
Yeah, Satan's my dad, you know, whatever, you know. And then that later on moved to, I had a band called IUD, and that lasted maybe about a year, and then Hossbrüten was a band that I had for a lot of years and reincarnated, you know, as even 10 years ago and 5 years ago, back and forth. So, and then I've always known the Mentors. I would go to Hollywood and hang out with them, and El Duce would teach me how to play drums, and I'd jam with them, and later on replaced El after he passed away.
Yeah.
And they were just good friends, you know. Just, that's all that mattered. It wasn't about, you know, the music and anything, which I love the music. It's rock and roll. It's Ted Nugent with and UFO and all those amazing rock bands of the 70s. A little harder, but with super funny and dirty lyrics, you know, which sometimes nowadays isn't too proper.
Yeah. So let's go back to Hossbrüten.
Okay.
So what year is that, do you think, when you started that?
I think it was 86.
And you came out with a record, right?
We came out with, well, we had demo cassettes that we'd sell, and we'd been on records. California Got It, Volume 1 or Volume 2, a few other compilations. We didn't make, we didn't have the money to make full-on records.
Yeah.
We did the tape trading and tape sales, which was, that's what got us through any tours to any gigs or anything, and that's the only way we made money was shirts and cassettes. And at the time, having a record wasn't feasible to travel with the way we traveled in a station wagon.
When did you start throwing your own shows? How did you learn to do that?
Well, my dad, like I said, he was in the American Legion, and he ran the American Legion Hall. And I would get, you know, through people just would contact me and call me at my house and find my number. Hey, I'm in, this is so-and-so from this band, and we need a place to play. And then I'd ask my dad, I go, can I rent the hall out for bands? And it was kind of hard, but he let me do it. And he says, as long as you clean it up and there's no destruction, which the city hated it. The Bakersfield City, I mean, we always had to change our production name to something else and get a permit, which my dad would help me. And they couldn't really turn down the permit because they would have to turn down all the permits for the Legion Hall, you know, whoever rented it for a dance or something. So they were kind of stuck in a rock and a hard place where they had to grant me the permits. You know, the fire department could say, oh, there's not enough electricity or what. I don't know what it all entails, but they couldn't do that. They couldn't do that to the American Legion, which is across the street from the Fox Theater and stuff. So they just had to let me do it. And it just so happens that people just knew that there was this crazy kid in Bakersfield that can, you know, whether it's a backyard party or something, could get you a gig. But I never did the backyard parties. Me and my buddy Steve Langston and Kevin Williams would just rent halls and throw punk rock shows.
That's cool. So that's the first venue that you're really doing shows at, American Legion Hall?
Yeah, the American Legion Post 26.
So what are some of the best shows that you threw there?
Mad Parade was really good. That was a really good show, really packed. Battalions of Saints was really good. My friend Pete, we did sound mainly for him because he had Hyrax, Excel, Final Conflict play there. And I was a part of it, but just in a roundabout way through my dad's place. So it wasn't just me throwing them, but I was a part of that whole group of people that would do them. And, you know, and some of the other shows were like at the Fraternal Hall, because there would be, you know, somebody would already have the 24, I mean, Post 26 already rented out. So we'd go to, like, the Fraternal Hall, and that's where I had, like, Terminal Holocaust and Sacrilege, and a lot at Simon Juarez Hall off of Baker Street. We had Sacrilege and Black Death and The Mentors. The first show of The Mentors was there, and that was just a blowout. It was fantastic, and that was probably one of the funnest shows with Mentors, Chaotic Evil. SMD was supposed to play, we broke up, and then I jumped in playing bass for a band called the Grogaholics, and they ended up playing.
So let's talk about, like, geographically. You've got Salon Juarez, which is more on the east side off Baker Street.
Yeah.
And where's the Fraternal Hall
at? The Fraternal Hall is still there. It's next to, it's on California, a half block east of Union, right next to the welfare department, which used to be like John Deere Tractor at that time. And it's just a small hall. We did a few on the Jeffrey Street Hall, off of Union and Jeffrey. It's on the west side of Union. Just there's like a little half block before the canal. There's a veterans hall there. And that's, you know, we had shows down there too.
Yeah, so what year did you start doing shows then? You think? And how old were you?
Man, I think it was 85. 1985 really started out doing that. And I was connected in some way or another because, one, I had a PA. Everything I did in my life was for music. So I would buy a PA. So if your band's playing, Mark, we need a PA for this. Okay, I'll bring my PA down. Or my friend Todd, Big Jed, had one half of the PA and I'd have the other half, and we'd combine it for, you know, so we can do it. I mean, we were really working with just the bare minimums that we could get by with, which I look back, I'm like, God darn, how did we pull this off? But, you know, we did it, you know, and that was about 85, I think.
What were the crowds like at this time? I know we've talked about how at the time a lot of different scenes were coming together.
Well, the early crowds in Bakersfield, it was a lot, and we were known in Maximum Rock and Roll magazine and a lot of other places to have insane shows, fights, violence, and a lot of that was perpetrated by the Bakersfield Californian.
Okay.
Would like the night Hyrax came and played down the street close to what is now Samco, which was...
Was that the one where there was an assault?
Yeah.
And they blamed it on...
On the show.
Yeah.
So that was a Circle K back then. So a homeless lady got assaulted sexually by a homeless man or two homeless men. And they put in the paper, rape at punk rock show. And that was the Hyrax XL Final Conflict show. And it made it really hard on us because it was a total fabrication, other than they just didn't want these kind of shows going on. But when we did these shows, everybody would come out. Every part of the Death Rockers, which is now considered goth now, Death Rock was the term back then. We would get the punk rockers, we get some of the metalheads, the more extreme guys, and then the skinheads started showing up. So we had to pretty much get rid of them, but it was a rowdy time.
But this was not like sharp skinheads that
There was a few,
cool.
There was a few Jake Chavez and a few of his other friends, but these were, you know, some Nazi skinheads, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, I still see a lot of them around now, and they're, you know, popular in the scene. I'm like, once a Nazi, always a Nazi in my eyes. It was violent. It was violent. There was a lot of fights because there's a lot of pent up, you know, not a lot to do. So there's a lot of pent up aggression with some of these people. So they would they'd fight.
Yeah.
And then later on, what luckily came to be was I found a guy who opened up a little all ages coffee house disco.
Are you talking about John Bentley?
Yeah. About John Bentley.
Bam Bams.
Yes, Bam Bams. And he opened up originally next to the Notorious Cellar, which was a gay bar in town that was under Broadway or Bronx. I think it was Broadway. Right there on the corner of 20th and Chester. In the backside, there was a cellar, like a basement bar called the Cellar. It was a gay bar.
Yeah.
And all the punk rock kids would go there, and people would cruise Chester, and that's where they would loop around on 19th to get back on Chester. And they'd throw their beer bottles at the people in front of that was hanging out because they'd, you know, yell obscenities at them. And, like, we didn't care. We were hanging out and having a good time. We didn't care about what people liked or anything. We just,
yeah,
you know, those people were our friends just as much as anybody else. And then John opened this, like, kind of disco-ish thing, and I got to know him pretty good, and he liked me because I was a big guy, and I was already going back and forth to San Francisco, and I would make sure nothing would happen because I was used to taking care of things when they happened, stopping fights and stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it became Bam Bams later on when he got the new location. So I was already in San Francisco knowing so many bands, going to Los Angeles knowing... I mean, I saw Primus before they were huge, like major years, like at the Anti-Club, and got their numbers, got to know their manager. All kinds of bands that are now huge, like, you know, like Operation Ivy, which turned into Rancid, and yeah. I lived at the house with them, you know, and...
That's cool.
Jesse was my roommate, or I crashed on in his living room for, you know... forever, you know, and the Dwarves, and, you know, I even, you know, had association with G.G. Allin and Gwar and the Mentors and Crime and Neurosis, and they were all my friends, you know, they were,
yeah,
you know, so I'd try to get them all into town, and a good friend of mine named Jimmy Green opened up, previous to Bam Bams, a club called The Mask.
The Mask, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, it was a great club. A lot of bands played there. Cadillac Tramps played there. A lot of the really early stuff played there. And I got to say, it just came to my mind, one show that I didn't have anything to do with, it was one of the earliest shows I went to, because I went to a lot at the Bakersfield Inn, you know, like Love Canal and Black Flag, and there was even some shows at the Fox. But at the Encore Dinner Theater, three blocks from my house, RKL and NOFX played.
Oh.
And Fatal Vision and a band called Deicide, which was a local band featuring, you know, a lot of my good friends, R.B. Contreras and Tom Ratcliffe and David Butler.
And I've seen the flyer for that show. It's cool.
And I was there, and it was right after. See, a lot of people don't know this. NoFX had a singer before that who passed away, and they had to do the show as a three-piece show, a three-piece band, I should say.
Wow.
And that show was done by Dan Seitz. And Danny Seitz was the one that did all of RKL's album covers and flyers and a lot of that early Nardcore artwork, who also ended up doing artwork for Metallica when they got really big, and Gwar and everybody else that you could possibly think of. You know, there's so many connections to everything, because like even me living in San Francisco, doing, you know, working at the clubs there, I got to know Liz Fairbairn, who was the manager of Gwar, and Danielle from Gwar, and you know, it's just a big mush of just nobody was famous yet, and we were all friends.
You mentioned NoFX. I heard that Fat Mike had a really big beef with Bakersfield for something or other. Do you know what that was about?
Well, he had a beef with me once.
Oh.
He came to play Bakersfield and needed a stop on a Wednesday. And he gave me the price that they would do it for. And I said, I don't know how many people I can get on a Wednesday. I've never done a Wednesday before, and I don't think it's going to be good. And so kind of talked me into it. Says, you give me this Wednesday, I'll give you a better gig the next time we come back. I'll give you a Saturday. And I said, NoFX on a Saturday night would be amazing, and I'll pay what you're asking. So we had a contract that said they were going to get $800. Now, $800 back then was a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, for me to, you know, I didn't have a normal job. I was a punk rock kid just hoping that I can get, you know, I kept the tour price down at $4 or $5 to get in. I had to give John money for the club and the sound system and everything. So it wasn't just NoFX's money. I had to come up with money, because like a lot of the early punk rock shows we'd throw, we'd rent Pacific West Sound, which was called Sounds Unlimited back then. And we were into him for $1,000 right off the bat, no matter what, you know, if we wanted a decent PA at these shows. So NoFX played, and it was on a Wednesday, and it was a fabulous turnout. It was packed. I got paid off for the last shows that I did with John, because I owed him money, and used that money to square up. And he's like, well, we want $2,500. I said, we have a contract for this much. And there was no sell. There was nothing on the back end for these shows.
Yeah.
And it really kind of bummed me out with his attitude about it. And I was like, man, I was taking a chance here to offer you the money I did. And I covered my ass with the sound and everything that I had to do. And I don't know if that's the beef everybody's talking about. I don't know if that's the only time he had a beef.
I just remember in the Bones of Brundage documentary, people talked about how he was telling people, don't play Bakersfield and stuff like that.
Maybe so. I mean, a lot of people talked about not playing Bakersfield because Dr. No played at Poncho's Gym on Edison Highway, and there was a little punk rock gang called the Eight Ballers.
Okay.
And Chotty ended up getting in a fight with Kyle, the singer at the time. Dr. No was a three-piece band with Kyle, Ishmael, and the original drummer, who I don't remember his name. And it ended up being all of the Eight Ballers jumped on Kyle and the band, and they didn't end up playing. You know, luckily I saw the sound check and I got to see Dr. No for the first time that back then. But that led to a lot of the dark cloud over Bakersfield, which was that.
Because once word gets out and among some musicians, like we said, it's all connected.
Yeah,
and everyone knows.
Yeah, it's all connected. And you know, it was a rough scene. We were a hick town back then. I mean, Bakersfield's big now, but I mean, we're talking back then 74,000 people in this town, and Rosedale Highway was still fields, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where we partied, at a place called the Couch or the Dreads or wherever, and it would be, you know, pretty primal. It was like watching Apocalypto with everybody dancing around a fire, you know?
It's hard to control all that. And when you're in charge, too, you have a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
But what were your plans when there was, like, it felt like there was going to be a riot or something? What did you do?
Well, we had to hire security, straight up, Transwest security, and then we'd have our own friends helping out. So it wasn't, the fights happened, but they were stopped pretty quick because people knew that. You know, we'd even put on the flyers, if you guys keep your shit together, we'll be able to have more shows. So no fights, you know, leave your bullshit at home. You know, we'd put that stuff on flyers all the time. That was pretty much how we tried to defuse it. And we went on like that for a long time. And Bam Bam's was definitely, I mean, the first show we had there, we brought the Mentors back and it sold out. And it was a blowout again, and it just opened the doorway for so much more. And I was like, I do not want to throw shows anymore, because I did have to put my name out there, and if the show didn't go good, because at that time we started having shows every weekend, which was a good thing, but it was also a double-edged sword. People were getting too used to having shows. So, I'll get it. I'll go to the next one. You know, they didn't really have to live through the 80s. This was already the beginning of the 90s. So they didn't have to live through the 80s where the cops would shut down shows.
Yeah.
Or make sure you didn't have it. Like, Kern County Fair had Primer Gray in 1984. And Big Jed Todd Thompson was singing at that time. And the sheriffs went on stage and yanked them off stage for no other reason than that they just didn't like the way they looked. And it was funny, Todd had the mic going, this cop said he's going to hit me with a billy club if I keep talking. Oh, he's getting the billy club, you know, and giving play-by-play. He said he's going to take me to jail and beat me up, you know, and giving a play-by-play of the whole thing. But once they saw that circle pit going around with a bunch of kids with mohawks and stuff, you know, They flipped out, and it was honky tonk back then. It was a honky tonk situation, and the police didn't like it. So come to the beginning of the 90s, it got lighter. We were able to do it more often, and people didn't understand that. Oh well, now there's going to be shows all the time. They kind of took it for granted. Where before, if there was a show, there would be a year, maybe two, before the next one. You know, so it was quite different, and you know, and everybody would let off their anger, and you know, a bunch of rednecks would come just to start problems, or a gang of cholos would come to start problems, you know, out front, you know, with the punk rockers, you know.
So, I also heard there was an incident with the Deftones. Was that at a show you threw?
No, matter of fact, I know what happened at the show, but I wasn't at that show. I was living in San Francisco at the time. I've only heard one side of the story, well, from two members of what was BPD. It was a rap group with R.B. Contreras and his brother. And I guess something happened early in the set where R.B. got hit with the mic stand. And it was either a member of the Deftones or their crew. Well, you don't mess with a local guy in their town. So I guess the poor Deftones, you know, Chotty spent, I guess, a month at the hospital here in town. RB got charged with it and stuff. Yeah, it was a nasty situation. And me and RB grew up together. One of our first, you know, kind of endeavors of trying to start a band was with him. And so I pretty much was around that. But no, I was living in San Francisco at that time, so I wasn't at that gig.
Even with all these obstacles, you stayed in the music business and you kept having shows for a long time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely. That was the whole thing I wanted to do is I'd take the Greyhound to San Francisco. I'd work at the clubs there. I mean, I worked at so many clubs there, mainly the Gilman Street Project. which later changed to 926 Gilman when this guy Lou Everett took it over.
Yeah.
And I worked for both. I'd come back, and like Heather from Gilman would come pick me up and drive me back because I was good at diffusing problems there. Or Kamala would come get me, and get me back over there. She's the one that got me in with the Operation Ivy guys, living with them. And she was in a band called Kamala and the Carnivores. And they were, on Lookout Records, too. So they'd get me over there, and then I would help out with whatever I could there and then come back and try to do that same thing with the list of music groups that I had from there. But the problem was that Bakersfield was such a rough place that a lot of those Northern California bands were kind of scared to play here. We'd always get the LA punk bands because they were rougher, or the Orange County bands.
Yeah.
Or Fresno bands like Capital Punishment because they're used to that world. San Francisco East Bay scene was more laid back. But I'm really proud that, I got to see Green Day's first show as Green Day, I knew them as Sweet Children or Sweet Baby before that with the original drummer, El Sobrante. Seen them so many. I knew the first time I saw them that they were going to be huge. I'm like, I'm looking at the Beatles and Cheap Trick of punk rock. These guys are going to be huge. And people would, no, they'll never sell out. Well, yeah, they did. They sold out major auditoriums. They sold out in a good way. And
what was their first show like?
Well, I don't know if technically it was a Gilman.
What do you remember from that show?
Their first show, I seen them as Green Day, because I seen them before at a party and stuff. There's a lot of kids there, real young. Like, I'm talking baby kids there, like 13, 14. And probably six rows deep in front of the stage at Gilman was girls. All girls screaming like they're watching the Beatles. I mean, tears in their eyes, and that's how I knew. I'm like, man. And my job, during the show was watch the side door, which is the load-in door, which is directly off the side of the stage. So I had to stand. If there's a band playing, I'm standing there on the stage watching that door and the side of the stage and making sure nobody's stage diving, because Gilman, that was one of the big things there. Against their insurance, they couldn't have that. It was kind of a thing. I think they got rid of it later because the insurance companies really didn't understand. But seeing Green Day was like really watching the beginning of the Beatles at the Cavern Club. Or to me, it was, because
that's cool.
I mean, not that I was into them. I mean, I knew they were good. I'm into bands like Cheap Trick and stuff, so I see the similarities. But into rock and roll, and they were a little different than everybody. They were pop.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, they're pop punk. And it was crazy. It was how big they were. And like, I've been a part of some big shows at Gilman. I remember after the Descendants stopped playing, they started doing a band called All and Operation Ivy played together. It was the only show at Gilman, I think, but there was really some tension because Bill Stevenson wrote all the songs for Descendants and All. And Silly Girl, the song, the girl that was written about, was the singer Jesse's girlfriend from Operation Ivy at the time. So they were really like, is there going to be a problem? And, it was kind of, but that show, I mean, I couldn't believe how many people were in that place. It was
kind of
wall to wall. So all those shows were pretty memorable. Like, I did RKL there, and I put Big Jed and Premonition, both from Bakersfield, and a band called East Bay Mud.
Wait, they were playing in Gilman?
Yeah.
Big Jed?
Yeah, Big Jed. I got
that's
Big Jed.
That's so cool. I never knew that.
Yeah, I got
so
Big
you
Jed.
Were, that's awesome that you were saying, look, to the people, you grew up with, hey, come play at the scene I'm part of now.
Yeah.
That's huge.
I always try to do that, and I always try to congratulate, not hate, I got them there, and it was an amazing show, and it was so crazy, the difference of music. you're talking Big Jed was bluegrass thrash. You know, I mean, it was as different from RKO as you can, but RKO guys were also fan of Big Jed, and Premonition was also fans of RKO, vice versa. And then for a while in San Francisco, I was living at Cap Street Studios with Carol Lennon and all them. And that's where I was taking drum lessons also. And bass, the Bomber, the drummer of RKO, was a fantastic bass player and drummer. So I'd take lessons. You know, he'd be all, hey, Mark, let me session your bass. And he'd take my bass to go to jam or something, bring it back with like a tampon taped to it. Well, that's where you put your fingers because you don't have a rear pickup. And, you know, he'd like, that was his reasoning. You know, I want that staccato tone. And he'd teach me a lot and on the drums. So living there was kind of a beneficial thing too. And that opened up a door for Big Jed to put a recording studio there, but that ended up falling through because we were in Bakersfield. We had a lot of people that mattered, you know, in San Francisco at the time and trying to take over the world there. And my friend had a band there, and he's from here, and called Sonic Brain Jam. That was getting pretty popular. You know, they do a lot of shows with the Dwarves. And where I lived with, like, Paul Hall, the son of Harvey Hall.
Oh, wow.
You know, in San Francisco. He was the original bass player forever in Big Jed, which a lot of people forget about, that he was a lot of that sound, that Malibu Barbie funk. That's when they were doing country funk punk, you know. And he was a major part of that sound. And you know, it's just weird because I'm constantly trying to play music there, like Noah from Neurosis after Christ on Parade. He was starting a band called Blister, and I was supposed to be the bass player for it, and I ended up going and joining a band called Crime, who's an old school, really 70s punk rock band, and then doing that, rehearsing with those guys, that falls through, so I'm joining a band on Alternative Tentacles called Tragic Mulatto, and then, you know, come back and I go to LA for a while. I start, you know, working with Roz Williams from Christian Death and doing sound and stuff for them also. And it's just funny how every time I would move, I'd see these people like Primus and like, I really want to get you in Bakersfield. And they're like, oh, you think Bakersfield's going to like us? You know, Les Claypool. I'm like, dude, I think you're going to be one of the biggest fans in the world. And they're like, ah, you know, that was like, it was just less than with two other guys, Curveball on drums, and this guy that looked like he just came off the San Francisco homeless scene, you know, on guitar, you know. And it was like one of their earliest gigs. I'm like, dude, you guys are going to be huge. And
did you get him to Bakersfield?
No, nobody would book him. I tried to get him at the Mask. I had their demo. They're all, oh, that sucks. I'm all, it's called Primus Sucks, you know.
They were ahead of their time.
Oh, yeah. It was just so out there, nobody could understand it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would always, get Bakersfield bands to come up wherever we could, whether we're booking in Fresno, too. A lot of times had to throw shows in Fresno just so my band could get to Fresno because the promoters weren't familiar with us, so we'd throw shows in Fresno and, you know, open the door for my band to play and other bands from Bakersfield to play by getting bigger bands from somewhere. And the punk kids don't know who you are, but by the time you're done playing, they do. And they're your fans now because, well, they must be our fans. They played here with this band and this band, you know. They must be good, you know.
You lived in San Francisco. You're part of the Gilman scene. After that, did you come back to Bakersfield in the 90s?
Yeah, I lived in both places. I could stay at Lou's flat as much as I wanted to. He had this like weird place off of University in Berkeley, and then I also had a place I could stay at in San Francisco. So I'd go to San Francisco for a month, come back to Bakersfield for 2 weeks. Try to, you know, do something here, go back to San Francisco, come back for a few months here to have band rehearsal and play a few shows with Hossbrüten. and try to set up some shows over there, but had to rehearse here because everybody's here. So it was back and forth. A lot of Greyhound buses, a lot of Amtrak. I got real familiar with Amtrak, loved that the most. And so that's what I was doing throughout the 90s.
What about the corn explosion here? How did that affect the music for you?
It was all punk rock and regular heavy metal. And then everybody that I thought that was real, like down to earth, like these guys are hardcore punks. These guys are real. The next time I saw them, they got cornrows and Adidas on. Those guys, I grew up with those guys. I know them from their old glam bands. John would sometimes sing in our band Jell God, which he considers the best band of Bakersfield. I mean, he wants to record us still. He goes, man, we got to get in on
Jell God?
Jell God, G-E-L-G-O-D.
Oh, that's cool.
Dog Lake backwards.
Nice.
The corn explosion was a little tough because, I did spend some, my dad lives in Seattle, so, and that's where the mentors are from, which I spent a lot of time there. It was like the grunge movement there where everybody was doing the same thing, dressing the same way. So a lot of the bands that I really had some respect for all went in a row and really played like a really watered-down version of Korn, a real cliche version of it. And I mean, talking everybody, the metal dudes were wearing Adidas, the punk rock guys were wearing Adidas. And, I don't dislike Korn. I love Korn. I'm so proud of those guys. And John's one of my oldest, dearest friends. I mean, we'd sit at his dad's music floor and jam music together. He'd be on drums and I'd be on guitar or vice versa. Whatever we did, we always tried to play together. Like early, like 10 years old and he's 7, 8 years old. But we were in the music store all the time. And that was such a great memories of that. But I was very proud of them. But I wouldn't ask them for anything. I wouldn't ask them for anything. Because all I could see was my friends and people I grew up with was always, hey, Monkey, get me a guitar. Philby, get me a bass. John, can you hook me up with a record deal? And everybody was doing that. And John always said, man, I would have always done it for you. I said, well, I'm sure you probably would have tried, but I wasn't going to ask, And, maybe stupid me, but I didn't want to impose on my friendship with that guy where I saw everybody that possibly could know him and the rest of the band imposing on that. And that was my take on it. Everybody wanted to be in that, everybody wanted to be signed with that. Instead of finding, like, there was a band called Spike 1000 that John helped out, and rightfully so, because they stayed the same. They didn't change up. They got a little heavier, but they were still Spike 1000.
Yeah.
And Cradle of Thorns was Cradle of Thorns. That's why those bands got helped out, because they didn't cornrow their hair, they didn't wear Adidas and totally cop them where everybody else in town did. And that's why those two bands got help, even though Cradle of Thorns should have never changed their name from Cradle of Thorns, because if you're talking about something that really brought the scene together in Bakersfield in the 90s, it was Cradle of Thorns.
Yeah.
Hands down. No, Ty Elam, Chris Coles, all those guys were the ones that brought the alternative scene that would have been closest to what I say the L.A. goth and San Francisco and Seattle scene. They brought that style to Bakersfield, which was a lighter style than I did, which was a way less violent style, but they still had some problems because they were anti-fascist and stuff like that. And there was still a lot of gay people that would come to these shows because it was okay to, and they were welcomed, and hell yeah, they're welcomed. They were welcomed to my shows too. But the skinheads were a problem for Cradle of Thorns and stuff. And that was the only negative part about that whole thing. I think that's why they deserved the help that they got from Korn and Spike 1000 also, because they were two. And then I had my band Jell God at the same time. But we were partying a little bit too much to do anything, and we didn't really want to ask, you know. Yeah. We had our own thing going on, you know.
Yeah. But you did kind of join some new metal type, because you played guitar for Edema for a little bit.
Yeah.
Later on.
Yeah, later on, 2009 to 2014, I think it was. I didn't join them as their permanent guitar player, though.
Yeah, you were just doing some rhythm for them.
Yeah, and the sound effects stuff on guitar. I did that because at the time, I don't really want to mention his name. He's not with us anymore, but they had a guitar player that had a really bad drinking problem. And you might not think a bad drinking problem could be this bad, but it seriously pass out on stage, pass out of the clip. Really couldn't maintain it to do this. So it was really at a crazy part of their career, which I got a phone call. Dave said, "Hey man, can you play guitar for us?" Yeah, where are you? Well, we're leaving Texas. Our next show's in Baltimore in a couple of days. Or no, it was like they already left Texas. They were going to Baltimore, and the show was the next night in Baltimore. So I had to jump on a plane, learn the stuff on the plane, and then play the gig, which I've been really good at that. And you know what? And I'm forgetting that I wasn't really familiar with Edema's songs. I've only really listened to them one time before. I mean, I go to the recordings and stuff and watch them rehearse, the recording sessions and stuff. And there was a lot of people on their tip, too, so I really didn't want to bother them and go, even though Dave's been one of my best friends forever, and Chris and all of them. And there was a time where Dave had an issue where he couldn't be at a show, and I actually was in Edema with Marky, which is funny, and had to play bass. So they came down here. It was a situation. They came to my tattoo shop because they rehearsed in my basement, and they said, "You got to play bass for us tonight." I said, "Oh, I don't know your music." And they're like, "Well, let's go rehearse." I'm all, "Okay, how long was that? We're going to do an hour." Okay. So we rehearsed here, went to the show, and played the show, and that was the end of it. But that was with Marky. And then...
That was earlier.
Earlier, yeah. Yeah. And then 4 or 5 years later, I end up... Marky bells out on them. So Tim's going to vocals. Because it's just... There was a situation...
Yeah, he's still singing now.
Yeah, he's back to singing now. And their original guitar player's not in the band. Mike Ransom, he's doing something else. And I ended up playing with them, you know, as a guitar player. I had to learn the songs on the flight. And, you know, which, if you don't rehearse a song forever, you know, I knew them well enough to where I was familiar with the changes and stuff, but I didn't really know them. I didn't pay attention to them. It wasn't my bag. I'm into punk rock. I'm into harder stuff. And, you know, ended up doing the tour. We did the Hell tour, which, man, we were in the snowstorm of the century, playing, you know, the East Coast for 3 months, and promoters still talk about this tour like, "We can't believe you made it through this they call it the Hell Tour, and,
wow.
And Edema's known for making it through this. I mean, there's some major stuff that made world news with Edema when I was in the band, you know. I really don't want to mention what it is because the band knows, and if you weren't around at that time, you know, it was a crazy time. But I didn't do that to get into new metal. And I didn't follow playing new metal after Edema. I was doing mentors at the time of Edema. So I'd do 3 months with Edema, come home, do a 3-month tour with mentors, go back to playing on the road with Edema while having my tattoo shop at the same time.
Yeah, you were like a hired gun.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
Edema
hired gun.
Thing.
Yeah, you know. They had me down as a member of Wikipedia, you know, in Wikipedia and stuff, which, thank you guys, appreciate that. And I did get, you know, free guitars from Schecter for it and stuff, and it was nice, you know,
it's cool
getting that. And I could give a rider list to somebody saying, "I want this kind of amp and this kind of amp and have it here, and I want the head mic'd even though the head doesn't make sound, just because I want the tube noise to come through," you know, a bunch of silly stuff, and I only want green M&Ms, you know. It was kind of nice, you know.
Yeah, that's
cool.
I
got to to enjoy, you know, going on tour with a, you know, like I said, the Mentors for months, which was insane tours, and then Edema, which is insane tours, and it's just crazy. It was busy. It took some years off my life, I'm pretty sure. But I've never been a druggie, so I was always the sober guy. I didn't drink or anything, so I haven't drank alcohol since I was 25 years old. Yeah.
Wow. So you mentioned your tattoo shop. You're running a tattoo shop at the same time in the 90s, right? This opened in the 90s?
94.
And how did that start?
It started with Bill Vamboni. And we were in bands together and stuff, so he ran his spot that we would rehearse at above Guthrie's Alley Cat, and that became Mad Dog Graphics. And he had a partner which immediately dropped out, which I bought that partner out. So me and Bill were partners in Mad Dog, and then Bill moved to Los Angeles, and then I got stuck with it, you know, but not stuck with it in a bad way. I've been tattooing. I mean, I did my first tattoos probably 86, 87 on my friends Mike Sims and Matt Tolles and a bunch of other people. I was tattooing people with a homemade machine at Jefferson Park on my uncle's friends, you know. with a homemade machine. I was already tattooing, and I just didn't think of it as something that would be a business. I just, and then it ended up as a business. And so Bill moved, and I kind of just did my own thing with it, and I'm still here, you know. I've owned a shop longer, you know, than anybody else in Bakersfield. I mean, people have been tattooing just as long, but, I mean, I have the oldest shop with the consistency, 30 years of the same person running it and owning it, not being sold to 15 people along the way. There's shops in town that have been sold multiple times, and they're, you know, oh, we're the oldest someone. No, you're not, you know.
And you're like the first tattoo shop that kind of did alternative styles. I don't know if that's the right word.
Well, I wouldn't say. I mean, we were doing graffiti tattoos with, you know, Cabe and stuff back in the early days, and a lot of color work and stuff. That wasn't, that's pretty much what any tattoo shop going through that time was doing, because that was popular. You see fads in tattooing, like the lower tribal tramp stamps, and then for a while we had, you know, man, we so many fads, the Hurley logo, you know, you just, things would be in fashion, they wouldn't be in fashion, the jewelry tattoo under the boobs, the underboob tattoos, you know, the neck tattoos, which I call them the man stamps, the ones on the throat, you know, and then you see the tramp stamp goes from the above the butt to the chest, and then below the chest, and who knows where it's going. But yeah, there's fads in tattooing, so you know, we couldn't control what was popular at the time, but we did custom stuff, which a lot of shops didn't do. They you either pick it off the wall or you didn't. And then I did the Friday the 13th special back in 97, before anybody even thought of it. And that became a worldwide phenomenon. People were nice. Like people that were known now, like Oliver Peck and stuff, for the Friday the 13th. Like, people would ask me at conventions, "You do what? You offer $13 tattoos on Friday the 13th? Yeah, with a $7 tip. Yeah, it's, yeah." I go, but those people all come back. You know, they end up being, you know, valued customers, and they do that. But I can say that Mad Dog, I remember working in Reno, because I also worked in Reno, and I got let go because the guy found out that I wasn't white. I was Mexican.
Oh, no.
I was Mexican, so he didn't like that. So I had to go get an apprenticeship at a different tattoo shop in San Francisco, and so I could say that Mad Dog was one of the first shops in United States, well, at least California, that had an African American working at it, because that was a big hell no back then. The tattoo scene was different. It was a white honky tonk tattoo scene. You didn't really have Chicanos in a tattoo shop. It's common now. Had Chicanos. When I had a homosexual guy tattooing for me, openly flamboyantly homosexual. I didn't care. He was a great artist, still a great artist, Ricky. Man, I got a lot of shit for it from other people in the industry. Like, you know what kind of door you're opening here? What kind of precedent you're saying? I had a trans person doing piercing for a while. People gave a shit for it. Becomes a little bit normal after a while, and people realize, oh, that person's cool and stuff. And it's all about, you know, I think I'm more known maybe for that. And some people could say it's a good or a bad thing, and the Friday the 13th thing and stuff, more so than changing what style of art people got, you know, because we did that. I did that. And I don't care. There was nobody to do it back then. I mean, other people who are famous tattooers right now, really famous, they have their own line of ink, would bully him out of the shop because he was gay, you know, stuff like that. And boy, if people knew that now, they would boycott him, you know, especially being he still owns a shop in Hollywood, you know. Now he owns a shop. But, you know, it's stuff like that. The tattoo scene is like the punk rock scene, and it has its own weirdness about it, which kind of disappeared. Now it's it was really honky-tonk, and it was kind of a free-for-all thing, but it had its rules. You didn't open up next to somebody. If you wanted to tattoo in a town and there's a tattoo shop there already, you got to call and kind of ask permission. Yeah. You can't be on the same street. You can't be within a certain miles from them, you know. And back then, there was less than 100 shops in the United States. Now wow. there's 100 shops almost in Bakersfield, you know.
Yeah. That's crazy.
But I did do the tattoo shop to pay to do music.
Okay, so it was kind of like funding to keep your music going.
Yeah, the tattoos paid for my music gear, PA gear, because I did PA sound for so many bands. Papa Roach, anybody that came through the Montgomery World Plaza when we were doing those shows there, I did sound for Tim Gardea. All those shows, Freak Fest, all kinds of shows. I was the.
So when did you do sound for the Deftones when they finally came back?
No, because that was too big of a show.
Oh, too big of a show.
Yeah,
I just thought because Tim Gardea threw one of those.
Yeah, it's either got to be Pacific West Sound.
Okay.
But if the venue was small enough, I wouldn't say small. If it was a smaller venue that I could handle, I would do the sound, because Pac West didn't want to do them.
Yeah.
You know, and would charge way too much for them just because they had to have a certain budget, and it was nothing against them. It's just the way the industry is. Brent was more happy that I did those shows than I wasn't considered competition. So I would do all the, like, Montgomery World. I did almost all the Dome shows except for I didn't do COC and Motorhead because I was... My band American Standard just got to Cleveland, Ohio that night to play our first show. And so I wasn't here, but most of the shows at the Dome I did, unless it was like My Chemical Romance. If the writers in this band was at such a stature that they needed, we want this Midas board, or, you know, I had a Midas console, but I didn't have the big, big one. And they, yeah. that, I mean, and a place like the Dome took, I mean, I had a pretty good-sized PA system, sound system, but that place needed a lot of sound reinforcement to stop the echo and the bad sound of that place.
Well, it was a dome, yeah, so it was round, dome. Right? Yeah, so the sound has got to be insane.
Yeah, it was insane.
Your top three shows you did sound for?
Oh, man, I couldn't even tell you.
One of the reasons I ask these types of questions is because a lot of people, especially younger people, don't even know how many legendary bands played right here.
Flock of Seagulls. I did sound with that with Front Porch Music. That was at B. Dowell's. So a lot of times I would help Sounds Unlimited at the time, which ended up being Pacific West Sound. So with him, I did Arcale and Beyond Possession at B. Dowell's. I mean, this is early on. and I helped him do sound there. That wasn't a sound that wasn't my sound gear. I worked for somebody else. But doing that was awesome. Flock of Seagulls. And then I did sound and ended up going on tour with him for a little bit, a band called Exposé, which was three beautiful girls from Miami and a tape player. For some reason, they liked the way I did it and asked me to come along. Didn't realize I was only 15 years old. So I had these like 22-year-old girls in lingerie every night singing, and then would be, "Oh, you're so cute," and messing with me. And I was like, man, and they're just doing cocaine everywhere. But they were,
oh my gosh,
they were huge. They had like the song, "You're Taking Me to the Point of No Return." You know, it was like a huge 80s hit.
Wow.
And so
15 years old, you're already doing sound for a big
yeah, they were huge.
Like
they were
so
huge.
So you're really
submersed in
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you've been fully immersed in music your whole life.
My whole life.
Reflecting back, what's the top three concerts that you played at?
Okay. I would say the Eindhoven Metal Meeting. We played with Creator, Exodus, Dark Angel. We're on a major stage.
Wow.
I'm the lead singer, drummer. I have the original two other members of the Mentors, which Sicky on one side and Heathen Scum on the other. It's a roar that you feel the pressure of the audience roaring back at you. Sold out. You know, you're in Holland, the Netherlands, and it's amazing. And they got me whatever drum set. I asked for a big Ludwig double bass kit, you know, just to ham it up a little bit. And we needed, they asked me what equipment. I want Marshall stacks on the stage and stuff. So it was a rock concert. Bone, like, I have arrived kind of moment. Even though we had other big shows before, like we did the Legend stage at the Punk Rock Picnic, which was amazing too. And all you see is a big circle of people just moving when you play. And that was, yeah, those two shows were amazing. Another shows that were amazing was, and it was a big hell to get there. I left with Edema to play in El Paso, get on a plane, which, there was problems with it being delayed and stuff, so we have to do this other plane. And I don't remember if it was a propeller plane or not. So we have to land in Arizona and Phoenix during a sandstorm. And we have to get off the plane on the tarmac. And it was like being in a blow dryer, like crazy hot winds like I've never felt. With sand, I mean, enough to take your paint off the car. Then we finally get to El Paso. We play the Speaking Rock Casino two nights in a row. The first night we're playing with Jackal. I don't know if you know who Jackal is.
I'm not sure.
If I told you the song, you might. They had that song with the chainsaw. "I'm your chainsaw, baby." And then... Rah, 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 rah.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. Yeah.
And then we played the second night with Buck Cherry.
I remember them from the 2000s.
Yeah, that song, "All Lit Up Again." Yeah, so what's crazy is the Edema guys, you know those guys. And then the guys from the band, Buck Cherry, is like Mentors. You know, like they point me out and they're like, you know, tripping out that I also do that, which happens all the time. People will never pick me out from being with Edema. People like famous people, like Prince's band members. Wendy and Lisa, and I have witnesses to this. I'm in Amoeba Records, and they see me with a Mentor shirt, and they're all, "You're Mad Dog. You're the singer of the Mentors." And I'm like, "How do you know of the Mentors?" They're all, "Prince thinks Sicky Whitebeater's the greatest guitar player in the world. We all love the Mentors. It's hilarious." And I'm like, okay, which, you know, Tom Petty, and you know, there's all kinds of people out there that are famous with bad taste that like us. But back to the Speaking Rock. So we played two nights out there, and I'm talking 30, 40,000 people each night. And we're treated like royalty, beautiful hotels, and, you know.
So this is Edema. What year would have this been?
Oh, shoot. Probably 2011, maybe 2010.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And, you know, I've done a lot of shows in New York and stuff. And so those, the Holland Punk Rock Picnic and that El Paso, I got to tell you about this other El Paso show.
Okay.
So I think the guy was connected with the Speaking Rock Casino. He's an attorney, and he's an attorney for the members of, I think, the cartels. He's a defense attorney. So if there's some crime or whatever, he's like a major attorney. He hires us to play in El Paso at a place that's the size of Dodger Stadium. And we're there with Kill Devil Hill and all these other bands around that time, big bands, not anything to Kill Devil Hill had Rex from Pantera, Benny Appice from Dio on drums, and a bunch of other bands. I can't even remember. I need to go back and look at all the bands that played, but it was a huge to-do, and we're at a place that's the size of Dodger Stadium, and I'm like, crazy, okay, it's like two big stages. Well, right before showtime, they're setting up tables and stuff where the crowd would be, but it's just not that many tables. And we are there because the attorney hired all these bands to play for a quinceañera for his daughter's sweet 15 party, you know, the quinceañera party, because that's who she was into. So we go travel all this way thinking we're playing Dodger Stadium kind of place that's going to be 100,000 people there. No, there's about 50 to 100 people there just for this one girl, and her daddy just paid for it all and paid us buku money to go there. So that was a crazy
wow,
gig.
Wow, like
yeah.
a private gig.
It was a private
for
gig.
For somewhat a rich person, I
yeah.
guess. Huh?
Yeah, it was like having a transistor radio in a school bathroom, you know? I mean, it was weird, but yeah, that was kind of a crazy
surreal.
One. It was surreal, yeah, definitely, because like I'm upstairs hanging with, you know, the bass player Pantera, you know, and stuff like that, and you know, and I've been in those situations a lot where you're always surprised at who you know and who you meet, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. I've done a lot of gigs everywhere. And, man, to pull what is my favorite is really hard.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
It's really hard because there's so many good ones. And lately I forget about stuff. And then, like, an hour from now, I could probably tell you some crazy stories because I won't think about it until then, you know.
Okay, I'll be back in an hour.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just so many. We played Edema, had a situation. Dave, it's made national news, so I don't think it's going to be a problem to tell this story.
It's all right. He doesn't listen to it yet.
He will. We're playing in Hartford, Connecticut at the main stage. And the crowd's in there. And Dave had a DUI. And why this went to this, I don't know why, but we're on tour. Well, Bakersfield gets aware of the tour, and you know, we're going to be back soon. We're already in Connecticut heading back. And the Connecticut State police come in on stage and take Dave off stage.
Like he's a murderer.
Yeah. And they give him $1 million bail. It makes all the news of CNN, Fox News, it makes it all over a DUI in Bakersfield. Oh, it was really surreal. It was like being in a like, we can't believe you're doing this, but they did it. Well, they held him to the last minute and then extradited him back to California. So
wow.
Instead of letting him go.
So that's the reason you had to replace him for the tour?
No, this is This is the reason I had to stop playing guitar and go back to bass. So on that tour, I started as a guitar player, went back to bass, finished up the tour, came to Bakersfield, grabbed Dave, back on guitar, and then did more shows. It was nuts. But there was no reason that they should have picked up Dave for something that was being taken care of.
Yeah.
They just wanted to get the grandstand on it and to put out that they had the guy from Edema with a $1 million bell. That's a crazy gig. You know, that was a crazy thing. And we had a lot of those kind of incidents on this tour. You know, but,
wow.
You know, to remember old shows, I mean, it's hard because there's some, like, with the mentors that were really crazy, some with Hospruten, really crazy, American Standard. You know, American Standard toured and during when Luke was in Edema, before I was, I had my band American Standard that was being looked at Capitol Records, being looked at by Earache and a few other things, and we went on tour with Edema opening, and we got to play CBGBs. You know, before the
that's
close.
Cool.
Yeah, so I'm one of the only few people, you know, that got from Bakersfield that's ever played CBGBs. I've played pretty much every famous club, you know, there is, you know, like the Whiskey, the Roxy, Troubadour, CBGBs. I played, you know, BB King, huh?
Gilman.
Yeah, the Peabody's in Hartford, you know, Peabody's and Cleveland, Ohio, you know, I've done all these, like, you know, BB Kings, like I said, and stuff. But I mean, I don't know, where was I? Basically,
you just had a long, really successful, but also eclectic career.
Yeah,
just doing tons of stuff.
Yeah, I've done a lot of stuff with a lot of different bands. Played, you know, I even forgot, like, when Jim passed away from Karma Hit List. That was a band Ty was in with Cesario and stuff. And I had the radio show at the time, and I had them come on the radio show, and I'm interviewing them, and they're talking about the history of Karma Hit List and how Sean Starkey was the second singer. And then they're like, they played some songs, and I'm all, okay, who's on that song? They're all, well, Sean on vocals, Jim on guitar, Cesario, and they're all, you're playing bass. I'm like, I'm playing bass? They're all, yeah, you were our bass player at the time. Like, I was in your band? Oh, yeah, I was in that band. I forgot, you know. And I forgot that I recorded bass on their demo in Hollywood for Johnny Love from the famous band Love Hate. You know, he recorded the band and produced it and stuff. But,
that's cool.
Like, I forgot because there's just so much. And, you know, I'm getting older and I'm forgetting, you know, I'm the old man, you know.
To sum up, you've been a drummer, a guitarist, a bassist, a singer, you've had a tattoo shop, a radio show, you've been a promoter, what else? A sound guy,
engineer.
Like, you're practically have to, being a promoter, you also were a bouncer during that, right?
I was a bouncer for a lot of major clubs in San Francisco, and at the Stone, Full Moon Saloon, the Covered Wagon, Gilman Street, Berkeley Square, the Omni, everywhere you can think of in San Francisco. And then what was cool is I also worked at the Mitchell Brothers early on. That's the club where the strip club where the owner killed his brother, brother. Yeah, it was like world news when I was there. And you know, I even threw shows in Reno, you know, and stuff like that. You know, wherever I could throw shows and get my bands playing or my friend's band playing, that's what it was all about back then.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thanks for telling us all about Bakersfield history. So to end the show, we always talk about the local scene kind of now. Are there any local bands you recommend people to go check out?
Well, there's kind of a rehash on a lot of stuff. And I really can't identify with anything that's going on now. I really don't know what the music scene is like anymore.
Yeah.
And I try to. I know the guys that have some bands, but they're always changing their names, so I can't keep up on it. So, I mean, I think there's one called Poser Holocaust, Lambs in Flames. trying to do this thrash metal revival, I really can't keep up with them. And my problem is, I mean, I'm the epitome of the old punk that just thinks everything is a bunch of hipsters copping our style, and that's all I see now. That's all I see. People that change their hairstyle to be whatever concert they're going to, because as somebody that has the tattoo shop that sees people all the time that will lay judgment on me for whatever I do, or I'm old now or whatever, to lay that judgment on me and not know what I've done for this town, I pretty much say, fuck your band, because your hairstyle is going to be different next week when you go to that other show. and you're just a hipster because you don't know what we had to go through. And you're lucky that nobody is the way that they were when we did it. And I'm the epitome of that old grouchy guy that feels that way, which I hate feeling that way because I want to see bands play. But it's hard for me now. I keep seeing the same thing. Like, oh, that's cool, but that's a straight cop of Hyrax.
Yeah.
Or that's a straight cop of this, you know? And I just... You know, I hope I'm wrong. I hope that I am.
I think you're wrong in some cases.
And that's fine.
But I think you're right in some cases, too. Know, yeah. I definitely think the type of people that you're explaining are out there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So to sum up what you've been saying, basically to you almost, you know, punk is dead, but you want to be proved wrong.
Absolutely. I would love to be proved wrong on that.
Yeah.
And it's not really I feel it's dead, but it deserves to die, as Jell-O would say, you know.
I see, yeah.
You know, but I don't want it to be, but because it's the greatest thing that ever was, and it still could be the greatest thing. I love that spirit.
Yeah.
I love all the early stuff that wasn't necessarily had to be this sound. You could sound like the B-52s mixed with the Dead Kennedys mixed with Devo. And still be punk rock. But not everything needs to sound like the Dwarves. But I really want to see a lot of more original stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, sad to say, the last music I seen that was totally different was dubstep. At least that had a different sound. Not that I'm a fan of it, but that robot.
You respect how unique it was.
Yeah, it was so unique that I had no choice but to respect it. And I just want to see that again, you know, and not dubstep, obviously, but I want to see that uniqueness where it's still punk rock. It still has it all, but it's not a cop of something else, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it can be influenced. Because back then we had rock influenced punk, and now we got, you know, everything after that, metal influenced punk or pop. You know, it's hard to say, but there was no one to base your sound off of in the original incarnation of it, and now it's become everybody. I mean, for a while everybody sounded like Green Day, or they sounded like the Offspring. It's just, and then everybody sounded like Korn, and everybody sounds like this, and it leaves a bad taste sometimes. And I just and I want to be proved wrong. I want to see a totally unique band that will make me want to buy a shirt, that will make me want to do a lot of things. You know, I mean, I'd rather listen to Ghost a lot of times than, you know, which is kind of a unique take on something else that's kind of ABBA meets Metallica. You know,
yeah.
Well, at least that's original or something. So. Yeah, that's the way I want to be proved wrong though. I want to see some great bands. I want to see some greatness, something that I can pull out and say that's unique and that's going to go somewhere. And hopefully that band will stay together, not change their name 50 times and follow through, because unfortunately a lot of Bakersfield bands don't follow through.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not to sound negative, but I really just want to see some greatness come out of some people who deserve it from a town called Bakersfield and prove me wrong and prove everybody wrong and be that band that changes so much. Because we've had that. We've had that with Korn. Korn, that style before there was Korn. There was stuff they were influenced by, but there was nothing close to that.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why they deserve what they got. Not that I'm talking about bands making millions and millions of dollars, but a band like Plaid Retina and Visalia being a totally unique band that got on Alternative Tentacles that you can still get their albums, and they might be an old band, but you new kids are still discovering them, just like they are a lot of the metal, like Hyrax and stuff. They're discovering them, and they're more copying them instead of being influenced by them to make something of their own, and that's what I want to see.
Yeah.
And I play with a lot of bands. You know, mentors play with a lot of new bands, and I just can't listen to all the opening bands all the time, because a lot of times it's the same. Either they're screaming the same, or they're Cookie Monster, the vocals, or whatever, and it's like, it's the same. It seems like from the last 10 bands, the last 10 gigs, it's the same band, but with a different name. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So looking back from when you were just a kid playing guitar in your bedroom to now that you've played all over the world and been a part of all these important scenes in Bakersfield, in San Francisco, how do you feel that you've accomplished all that?
I feel thankful. The only thing I don't feel thankful about is I should have had a camera. I hate that there was no iPhone back then, even though I hate having an iPhone now, and I wouldn't be a part of social media if I didn't have to be.
Yeah.
But God darn it, people are so lucky now that they have that. You know, something I'm going to tell all these people, document everything. Document everything you do. And if you're playing music, document that. And don't go in when you're older and look back and say, well, this is what I did, you know, my early 20s. And then I got a job doing this and doing that. You know, you can have a job doing this and that, but don't forget that you have a passion for music, and be something great that comes out of this town, because there's no reason to ever give it up. If you got a woman that wants you to give it up, give up the woman, because she really doesn't care about you. Or your partner, whoever your partner is, whether it be a man or a woman, or if you're a woman and you're with a guy that doesn't want you to be in a band, you know what? They don't really care about you. Don't let nobody crush your dreams. Stay playing, because you can be a EMT and still be in a band. I've seen it many a times. And, you know, I see bands that have police officers in it. So don't stop playing. Document everything. Record everything, because I wish I had so much stuff recorded. Take video. Take it all. We're at a time in our lives where our memories can always be there, and that's my biggest regret, of not having all my memories and recordings and photos. But I feel so happy about everything I've done with music, and I was able to open doors for some people and be a part of something that was a lot greater than I am.
Now that's a perfect ending. We'll be right back.